Coming up later in the program, a new air filtration system that can kill the COVID-19 virus. Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Many Americans, especially younger Americans, don't know much about the Holocaust or other genocides in human history. Two nationwide surveys conducted last year bear that out. The Pew Research Center found that 45% of American adults knew that 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust at the hands of Nazi Germany. Only 38% of American teenagers knew how many were killed during the Holocaust. Another study conducted by the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany found that nearly half of Americans couldn't name one concentration camp, even though there were 40,000 of them. Why is it important that younger Americans know about the Holocaust and other genocides? Penn State University is working with the Pennsylvania Department of Education and other nonprofit organizations on the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Initiative to educate students about the events. To tell us more about it today is Neil Leifert, a lecturer in history and director of the Center for Holocaust and Jewish Studies at Penn State Harrisburg. Ileana Adler, Associate Professor in History and Holocaust Scholar for the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Education Initiative at Penn State, and Boaz DeVere, Assistant Professor in the Belisario College and Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Education Initiative at Penn State University. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you for being on today's program.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I'd like either any of the three of you to weigh in on this. But before we get into the initiative and talking about education, last week, the riot at the U.S. Capitol, there was a photograph that went viral of one of the protesters wearing a T-shirt that said, Camp Auschwitz. What do you think when you see that in 2021?
Well, I think we all agree that it signifies how important education is. I believe his T-shirt also carried a translation of the German slogan that hung at the entrance to Auschwitz that said something like, woke makes freedom. And I think education is key to putting all of this in perspective, right? It's not just the knowledge that we gain from learning about the Holocaust. It's the insight that we need. It's the perspective that we need to glean and develop to help us make better sense of the world today. That's just one of many examples, you know? So if a kid sees that, what are they to think? I mean, even if they know what Auschwitz is, they still can't make heads and tails of it. They can't really know what it actually means today. And that's where education can come in. That's where a teacher can make a big difference if she is giving the pedagogical tools to facilitate a discussion, for instance, around slogans and how they can influence people, or even style, right? Style versus substance. And so I think that's what it tells us as educators, the need to revamp that aspect of American education.
A person wearing a T-shirt like that, that says something that is that hateful, you know, I wonder how much that person does know about the Holocaust. And if they do know about the Holocaust, does it make a difference to a person like that? I mean, maybe they do know what it was, and it's just that they are such an anti-Semite that's the message that they're trying to portray.
Well, Ileana, my colleague, would you care to address this?
Well, it's like sitting around a table and listening to somebody spew some sort of racist or anti-Semitic comment. If you do push back on that, you're probably not going to convince that person. The reason that you do push back, however, is to make sure that the other people sitting at the table understand that this is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Ileana Adler?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree.
Because you're not going to change the mind of the racist who already believes that. I did see, I'm sorry, I interrupted. I did see the T-shirt. I did see the image. I don't know who the guy is. I'm assuming if you wear a T-shirt like that, you're either a Holocaust denier, which is probably what he relates to. But I can't be sure of that. But nonetheless, when you do things like that, you're probably not going to get your mind changed. What you're trying to do is to change, or at least to educate the people who would look at that T-shirt and say, gee, what's that? And maybe come up with the wrong conclusions.
Dr. Adler?
I would absolutely agree with my colleagues. There is a value in studying, learning, knowing something about the Holocaust simply in itself. But in addition to that, if we don't give students and others information, they're going to pick up these memes and symbols. I mean, it's all around us in popular culture, often misuses, misunderstandings of the Holocaust. And so we need to provide the real context and data and historical information with which the society at large can understand that. And I absolutely agree that we're not going to change everyone's minds, certainly, but many people, and this is something I am reminded of every semester. I teach a class on the Holocaust. It fills every semester. Many students are interested. They want to learn.
Okay, when they're a young girl, it's easier, right? Once someone is an adult, it's not just that you're not going to change a racist mind. It's too late. But if you speak to them at a younger age and you do it in a group setting like a school and you do it in an effective way, a way that respects the students and respects where they come from and gives them the ability to think for themselves and develop some skills around that, skills that can aid them in their own life on a selfish level, then you have a chance of really uprooting this sort of racism and backward thinking and counterproductive un-American thinking, because then the kids kind of develop their own path, regardless of what they might hear at home or in their neighborhood, etc. So that's part of what the initiative is all about, the idea that we can educate kids and create a new society in the way of doing that.
Before we get into talking about some of the specifics with the initiative, you know, I just provided a few examples, but those two surveys that I quoted from last year had a lot of information, a lot more information. It showed that not only younger Americans, but some adult Americans as well. And when I say younger Americans, we're talking about under 40, that didn't have a lot of knowledge about the Holocaust or some of the other genocides that have occurred on this planet in the last 100 years or so. Why do you think that is? Neil Leifert, let me ask you, why do you think that, I know it's been 75 years since 1945, but why do you think it is that so many Americans, or maybe I should say so few Americans, know so little about the Holocaust?
I was actually not aware of those numbers. I actually think that Americans probably know a little more about the Holocaust than most things. But the numbers are rather striking. However, if you ask me why... Well, I think the further out you get from the event, the further out you get from it, the less you read about it. And that's probably going to contribute to part of it anyway. The one statistic that you did mention that I was surprised about, that what did you say about only half of Americans could name one concentration camp?
Yeah.
That's a little disconcerting, actually. Sometimes, though, it depends on the media. It depends on films. I mean, right after Schindler's List came out in 1993, there was a big, you know, wave of interest in the Holocaust, just as there was after the 1978 showing on TV of Holocaust, the story of the family Weiss on NBC. There was this surge of interest in it. But now we're 27 plus years away, even from Schindler's List, which is where a lot of Americans, unfortunately, got their history of the Holocaust was from a Spielberg film. So I think that the further out you go, the less people are going to remember. But I think if you compare that to other events, people would probably know a little bit more about the Holocaust than most other events of history. For example, the French Revolution, or even the Civil War, for that matter. Too much time passes. And it's up to us to keep this in the mind of the public, in the mind of students, that these things happened, and it wasn't that long ago, and there are people still living who experienced this. And we're only really, we're still one generation out, you know, from the events.
I agree, Neil. I agree that other events suffer even more than the Holocaust. I mean, the Holocaust is quite well known in many circles around the country and around Europe and other places. And still, obviously, the knowledge is not there as well as it should be. Maybe there are two other questions we should ask around these numbers. So one would be, and we ask that of ourselves, how come, despite the fact that Holocaust education has been so robust for decades, right? You have so many great organizations, great authors, great media around the Holocaust, great teachers like Ileana and Neil, and you find them around the country and many other places, as I mentioned, Europe. How come despite decades of this, decades of great work and material by great organizations, not only do we have a situation where many don't know about it, but even worse, how is it possible that we keep saying never again, talking about it, marching around it, visiting Poland, talking, teaching, and we still have it happen again and again and again? We still have genocide. We still have racism. In many places, it's getting worse, not better. That may be the bigger question. Not why don't we know enough. Why aren't we doing enough with that knowledge? Why aren't we converting the knowledge that we do have into actual change in our society, into true insight and perspective and a greater humanity? That's the big question. And that's the question we ask ourselves at the initiative. And we say, you know what? We have a chance to still do that. It's not too late. There are great lessons here that can be learned. And we can, if we do it properly, what we had hoped for decades that hasn't materialized can still happen. So we're optimistic.
Devere Boas, you just hit on something that you anticipated my next question. In fact, we have heard since 1945, since the discovery by American troops, Russian troops, of the concentration camps in Europe, that we have heard never again. But yet, Armenia, Cambodia, Rwanda, all genocides. And my guess is, and I don't think I'm really guessing here, is that Americans, and not just Americans, but maybe the world, knows less about those genocides, much less about those genocides, than they do about the Holocaust. Would you agree?
Agree 100%. I would go a step further than that, Scott. Based on what we hear from teachers, the Department of Education, and what we've seen in literature, there are other difficult topics that you could argue are even more crucial than the Holocaust in American in the American educational system that suffer lack of pedagogy and lack of proper effective instruction. Take slavery as an example, right? If you think the Holocaust is suffering on the educational level, slavery is suffering even more because it's an even more difficult topic to teach. And so teachers shy away from it. And that's the problem. And I think in a way, better Holocaust education can serve as a beacon of light for these other topics that should be taught as well. So I agree with you, Scott. These other topics need to be taught. They're not being taught at all, or they're not being taught effectively. And there are several other, even more contemporary topics that fall under the umbrella of difficult subjects that teachers need to be supported in teaching. For example, what we're going through today. I mean, you can argue that every child today in our educational system is experiencing some level of trauma to one degree or another, whether it's simply because they've been placed in a situation where they don't know where they're going to be next day, or they're afraid for their parents and grandparents' life, or in some cases where they've lost family members, or they have sick relatives, or family members have lost their jobs or businesses. So kids are going through trauma today, and teachers need support and pedagogy and teaching tools to be able to tackle that in the classrooms. Teachers themselves are experiencing trauma. And so I think our job is to take these genocides, take these historical events, and to glean lessons out of them that can first and foremost help us here today, right now. That will take the knowledge-driven goal into a much higher plane of skill-driven goal. And in other words, we can use what we've learned to give us skills to cope better today.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, what we're going to be looking at is COVID-19. You know, we do this from time to time where we have a health professional. We have an infectious disease specialist on the program tomorrow to answer your questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. So be sure to tune in. During this portion of the program, we're talking about an initiative at Penn State University, the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Education Initiative. Our guest, Neil Leifert, lecturer in history and director of the Center for Holocaust and Jewish Studies at Penn State Harrisburg, Ileana Adler, associate professor in history and Holocaust scholar for the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Education Initiative at Penn State, and Boaz Devere, assistant professor in the Belisario College and director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Education Initiative at Penn State. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Adler, before we get into the initiative, because I do want to talk about specifics, how is genocide defined?
That's a huge topic. Genocide has been kind of redefined for the past, ever since the term was coined in 1943. It's something we're still coming to understand. On the simplest level, it's of course the effort to destroy a people, but currently genocide is defined the many steps that lead up to that physical destruction are also included in the definition. So the way that families are treated and separated in certain parts of the world as a prelude to genocide, even if it never comes to that, that we now consider that part of the process of genocide. And the kind of language that's used to describe certain groups to other them, to make them different from the rest of the population. Again, we now put that in the within the category of genocide, even if it hopefully doesn't lead to the final end, desired end from some people's perspective.
And the victims of genocide are people who have been targeted because of their religious, racial, or ethnic backgrounds, correct?
Yes.
It can also be political, I believe, even.
And political. Well,
with,
you know,
the definitions that are emerging.
We have an email here from a listener who wanted to point out that didn't want to minimize the statistic of 6 million Jewish victims of the Holocaust. But what is often overlooked are the minorities that go unmentioned and forgotten. Religious minorities, those with disabilities and birth defects, and those who were homosexual. To give due attention to these allows a broader view of those who are vulnerable and broadens the perspective of how the majority, good or bad, can and do disenfranchise the minority. That comes from Jerry in Harrisburg, and he is right that even though Hitler's final solution targeted Jews very early on, it also targeted gypsies and, as I said, homosexuals and other people that Nazi Germany saw as inferior, correct?
Not exactly.
Oh, really? Okay, go ahead.
Well, there were two groups that most Holocaust scholars agree that were victims of genocide: Jews and the Roma, or gypsies. homosexuals were not defined as a racial category. Neither were Catholics or Jehovah's Witnesses or communists. Although many of them, their numbers were decimated in Europe, they weren't necessarily on the Nazis' genocide list. The Final Solution, actually, even when you say it, the Endlösung actually just targets Jews. At the Final Solution conference, for example, that lasted 90 minutes in 1942, there wasn't one mention of any of those other groups. The mention of Jews, in fact, that's what the whole conference was called for, was to discuss or to pass on the information that Hitler had decided on the genocide of the Jews. So although there were other victims, they weren't other victims for the same reasons. A homosexual, for example, a lot of Nazis were gay. As long as they didn't engage in homosexuality, they were fine and they were tolerated. And they could live out a perfectly good life as a dedicated National Socialist. So although gays were certainly targeted, to be sure, but not necessarily victims of genocide. And neither were Jehovah's Witnesses, who, by the way, could get out of everything by just saying, okay, I'm not a Jehovah's Witness anymore. And you could be released from the camp and rejoin the, you know, the Volksgemeinschaft, the community of Aryans.
So, Neil,
the Nazis did begin with the disabled. You know, they did begin with the disabled in the early 30s, right? Those were their first victims. So they started by killing German Aryans, non-Jewish German Aryans. Yes. And the Germans were often grateful. Hitler received letters from parents thanking him for unburdening them with this vile specimen of a human being that was a disabled child. Mm-hmm. So it started with insanity and ended with insanity. The Jews, though, were the Satan of the Nazi religion, right? The Nazis replaced Christianity with Nazism. And if Hitler was their God, the Jews were Satan. That's what they needed. They needed some big, you know, symbol of opposition. You know, they projected actually onto the Jews their own vile, sick drives. For instance, they said the Jews controlled the world. The Nazis, that was their goal, was to try to control the world. The Jews never controlled the world, but that's how they operated. So the Jews served the Nazi cause in a unique way, different than, let's say, some other groups like Jehovah's Witnesses.
I think part of what we've learned in our study of the Holocaust is that there are many different victim groups, and also that even Jewish populations in different countries were treated very very differently because of the politics of those particular places and the populations in those particular places. So it's important to talk about distinctions and to look at how different groups were treated, but also to recognize that there are a lot of victim groups and that we absolutely should be speaking about them and thinking about their experiences as well.
I agree, Eliana, and that's exactly what we do at the initiative, is we understand that human beings are human beings, and we are for protection of all human beings, no matter where and what. And those distinctions sometimes are interesting, but the bottom line is that we, as human beings, need to stand up for what's right and develop our own perspective, our own critical thinking, and glean insight from the past so we can all together create a better future.
So,
and, you know, the distinction among the different countries, as Eliana just to quickly mention, I mean, sometimes it was even among different Jews within the same country. You look at France, and France differentiated between people who were Jews who were born in France, Jews who were foreign but were foreign for a long time versus having been arriving recently. So they actually made three distinctions among Jews in France. So, yes, it does get dicey and complicated. But the bottom line is always the same, isn't it? Human life must be protected.
See, this is just an education, the conversation that we're having. But Neil Eifert, let me ask you about this initiative, the Holocaust Genocide and Human Rights Education Initiative. Tell us what it is. Describe it, if you would.
Well, the initiative is to, I think it's part of Pennsylvania's Act 70, which doesn't furnish any guidelines, but it gives a kind of an administrative framework for the teaching of Holocaust in schools, secondary schools. How am I doing here, Boaz? Is that...
I think that's a slice of it. What we ask, Scott, is an initiative to train teachers.
Yeah, teachers.
Yeah, we work with teachers.
Yes. Somebody has to teach the teachers. Somebody has to train the educators to go out there and teach, but to teach it properly, to have the tools, pedagogical and otherwise, as Boaz mentioned. All of that's important. For example, at the Harrisburg campus, I am the only Holocaust professor. I'm the only one who teaches it. We have a lot of history courses, but I'm the only one who teaches this one. So there's nobody else not only to teach this one, but there's nobody else to teach any course on genocide. So the course focuses on the Holocaust. You can mention other genocides within the course, but there should be an expansion of that. These initiatives are probably going to end up a good thing by expanding the curriculum, which means hiring more professors and making more courses available to students, and maybe even further down the road at some point to actually have a major in Holocaust and genocide studies. But that's much further down the road.
Okay, but so the initiative, Scott, has to do with teachers who teach in the K-12 space. Higher education is something that we've been asked to look at, and certainly we're interested in it, but are primarily focused on the K-12 space. So we know that teachers, we believed initially this was only the case in Pennsylvania. We have found out now that it's a national issue. Teachers in the K-12 space, and not just teachers, but staff that work at schools, they want and sometimes absolutely have to teach difficult topics. Sometimes there's no choice. And they often lack the tools, the confidence, the support, the pedagogy to either do it at all or to do it effectively. These are difficult topics to broach for many reasons. They could be controversial. They could be complicated. It's possible that it's neither one of those. I mean, the Holocaust, as an example, is actually not that controversial in the public school system, unlike, let's say, climate change, right, or abortion. Holocaust is not controversial, but it's very difficult to teach, not just because of its complexity, but because of its appropriateness. How can a teacher figure out whether or not she can show this photo or talk about this to her 10th grade English students? You know, she can't do it in a vacuum. She needs help. Everything has to be customized and appropriate for the child. That's one. The second is that we believe not only do the teachers need help, but that together we can actually seize an opportunity that has not been seized in decades. And that is, you can actually use these difficult topics in education to propel higher learning, because you can use it, if you do it effectively, to teach kids critical thinking, to show kids that education has meaning, that they can make a difference, that they can step up and stand up to bullying, for instance, or whatever they choose, that they can make up their own mind, that they don't just have to listen to what their parents say about the Jews or about homosexuals. They can decide for themselves, they can educate themselves, they can discover for themselves, right? And the teachers can guide them through that. That could be revolutionary. We know that the educational system in America needs to be revamped today. We know that. And that's pre-COVID. Post-COVID, I think we have no choice. We have to really do something different here, right? I mean, the world is changing so quickly, but education hasn't kept up in a long time. It needs to be disrupted. We are not the only ones saying it, and we're not the only ones who are contributing to it, but we can help. We can help with that because we can take difficult topics and take them from something that teachers shy away from and are afraid to touch into something that teachers can't wait to bring into the classroom because they know what a transformational moment that can be for their students. The light bulbs will go on. They'll understand, oh, okay, I can use the past to contextualize the present. And even better, I can do something about it myself. That is transformational. And I believe that we are one of several like-minded players within the field of education that in coming years and maybe decades can really transform education, and with it, the children, and with it, society.
We have an email here from Eric who says, social studies curricula in Pennsylvania generally doesn't get past the Civil War until high school. That means most students don't learn anything concrete about the Holocaust until they're 15 years old. That leaves a lot of time for them to learn the wrong things from deniers, for example. Would you agree with that, that you talked about K through 12, but this is something that has to be addressed even before the age of 15 or high school?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, as we begin, because this is a new initiative, we have been tasked actually initially with creating material and working with the lower level schools. Secondary comes later, but more like, let's say, middle school. We plan to go all the way down to kindergarten. That doesn't mean we teach them about Auschwitz, but we can certainly work with them on developing their empathy, for instance. So yes, I this has to be done at a much earlier age, has to be done better, and has to be done with the child first and foremost in mind. We are not about checking off boxes and making sure that the American public knows about this and knows about that. It's nice for people to know, but that's not what we're about. We're about taking this important events and important topics and using them to give children the empowerment to really become better citizens of the world today. They can do that today. That's our belief. And that begins at an early age. That does not begin at 15. It begins at 5 or 6.
All right. So how will this be implemented? I mean, you're working with the Department of Education and also some other nonprofit organizations. How will this be implemented into Pennsylvania schools?
So teachers in the state of Pennsylvania have to recertify every 5 years. In order to do that, they need 180 hours of professional development credits. The most that a teacher can earn in 1 year is 60 professional development credits. We provide professional development. We award professional development points, helping teachers grow and develop and earn their recertification. And in doing it, we're doing it very differently than many other professional development providers. You know, we're a nonprofit, we're local, many of them are from out of state, and we focus on the needs of the teachers and the needs of the students. So that a teacher may really want to teach the Holocaust, but she's not sure, where am I going to fit it in? And I already have all these objectives to meet and learning goals to meet and state standards that I have to oblige to also accomplish. We help her with it, right? We help her achieve her goals, as opposed to saying, here's something else, it's important and you must teach it. We already fit it in, we plan it with her. Our whole training, the whole professional development is based around action planning from the moment that they apply. When teachers apply to our program, we ask them, what do you plan to do with this training? What's your action plan? What do you hope to get out of it? And then we assign each teacher a cohort, and that cohort has a team leader, and that team leader works with experts like Ileana to then facilitate the needs of the teachers and make it targeted so that at the end of the professional development, you don't just have a teacher walking back home and saying, wow, I really learned a lot, but I don't know what to do with this. But instead, she's excited to get back to the classroom and implement the action plan that she devised along with the experts as part of our initiative.
Ken from Hanover says, I learned about the Holocaust when I was at Point Park College in Pittsburgh in the 80s. We had survivors talk to the class. It tremendously affected my life, taught my children to respect other people. We're getting similar kind of emails from other people talking about visiting the Holocaust Museum in Washington and the kind of impact that it had on their lives. And I guess, Dr. Adler, what that points out is that when people get to know more about the Holocaust and these other genocides, it does have an impact on their lives, and it is something that they can pass down to their own children if they are adults, or if they are children, something that stays with them.
Yes, yes, it certainly is. And one of the ways that we can work to help that process and to help people get the most out of the resources and the sort of popular media expressions that they're already seeing is, for example, that we're creating a lot of educational material so that teachers can bring films into the classroom, but then they have the, we've, you know, condensed historical context for them and lesson plans for them and created really high level material for all different age levels to talk about the things that are already going on. I mean, you raised something right at the beginning, to have the tools to talk about those things and to help students make sense of what's going on around them and hopefully to bring that in a humanistic direction.
I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. We're getting a great response from listeners' emails who are talking about this, and it's something that it's not just history. It's something that is very relevant today, and I think that that's one of the mistakes that many people probably make is that, another history course. Well, this is not just history. This is history that can be learned from and can be applied to many of the events around the world today. I mean, we mentioned some of those other genocides that have occurred just in the last 30 years or so. Neil Lyford, Ileana Adler, Boaz Dirvar from Penn State, I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Just a reminder that even though Smart Talk won't be broadcasting live from the Farm Show Arena on this week during the Pennsylvania State Farm Show. The Farm Show is virtual this year, but we will be broadcasting, talking about agriculture and some of the events at the Farm Show. That's coming up on Wednesday this week. The COVID-19 pandemic has spawned technology to help mitigate the virus. LifeAir Systems has developed an air filtration system that can kill infectious airborne pathogens, including the coronavirus, and the company has also applied this technology to create portable rapid decontamination units for N95 masks that kill COVID-19 and other pathogens within all layers of the mask. To talk more about this is Catherine C. Warlow, who is CEO and founder of LifeAir Systems, Laura Epler, Chief Marketing Officer for Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Northeastern Pennsylvania, and Doug Engler, Lehigh Valley Regional Manager of Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Northeastern Pennsylvania. We'll talk about that in just a moment. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. So, Catherine Warlow, tell us about this air filtration system and how it mitigates the coronavirus.
Yes, well, good morning, and thank you for having us. The air purification system that LifeAir has developed, we actually developed this several years before the pandemic, and it was developed really to address a significant issue that was learned, and basically the impact of very low-level airborne pathogens, bacteria, viruses, fungi, and some of your chemical pathogens, on our ability to successfully grow the living cell outside of the body, in particular in human in vitro fertilization. So the genesis of the design of our system really came after we identified how critical airborne pathogens are to the success of the growing of the living cell. And once we determined the significance of this, we sought to purchase something commercially to protect our living cells and our human embryos. And there was nothing that we could purchase, much to our shock. And that was really the genesis of LifeAir and the design of our air purification system. Because we were trying to protect the human embryo or the living cell, we set the bar very, very high. And we wanted our air purification system to be able to remediate the anthrax spore, which is the most difficult biological spore to kill. And therefore, if you can do that, it provides a significant reduction of all other airborne bacteria, viruses, including COVID, and fungi, those that are infectious and are a far greater concern in healthcare. So we're now installed in over 50 leading healthcare facilities and networks throughout the country. including Northwestern and Stanford, UCSF, Iowa, UConn, Duke, Yale. And it was because the bar was set so high to protect the human embryo or the living cell that we're now being installed in hospitals and long-term care facilities in basically remediating all airborne bacteria, viruses, and fungi, and reducing infections and improving patient wellness and preventing illness, reducing length of stay, and realizing improved economics. And we had a very strong installed base prior to the pandemic. And early March, we started receiving phone calls from the physicians that already owned our system. And they were asking, you know, we recall that you mentioned that the system that we now own remediates the anthrax spore. And if that's the case, while we're seeing patients, will it remediate COVID-19? And the answer is absolutely yes. It actually provides a 145 log kill. To put that in perspective, 6 log is sterility. So it provides an exceptional kill because of its original design on COVID-19. And it was really at that point that our company pivoted away from our core technology. We know our core technology was already proven and could deliver this kill. And given, you know, so many others that were being threatened by this pandemic, we really pivoted as a company and took from our core technology, that technology, and put it in different forms so that we could offer a number of LifeAir solutions to, say, your non-healthcare non-healthcare providers, for example, commercial office spaces and airport areas, dental practices, just in a way to help. And that's also when we pivoted and developed the Air N95 or Air PPE decontamination unit, taking the same proven technology so that we could safely disinfect N95 masks.
So if, you know, you listed a number of different hospitals, but say there were more companies, I don't know, maybe even individuals who wanted to purchase your air filtration system. If this air filtration system is being utilized, and I'm going to ask how it does work, but so there would be, it has been tested and shown that there would be no COVID. I don't know, I hate to use the word guarantee, but that any kind of virus would be removed from the air in that room or a bigger space.
We model, we have a number of different solutions using the LifeAir technology, and they're all unique. In other words, we look at the cubic volume of air in that space, no matter how large the space. We look at the shape of the ductwork. We look at the air handler. We look at the entire airflow and HVAC layout, if you will, specific to that space. And so that we can model it and then say on a single pass of air through the system, COVID-19 will be killed, influenza, pneumonia, yeah, I mean, the most common list of viruses that will probably be with us after this pandemic.
So, Laura Epler, your Chief Marketing Officer with Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Northeastern Pennsylvania. First of all, explain what the Ben Franklin technology is for those who may not be familiar, and how is the Ben Franklin partnership part of this air filtration system?
Sure. Well, thanks for having us all today, Scott. Ben Franklin is an initiative of the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development. We've been around for nearly 40 years, and basically our role is to invest in early stage and established manufacturers using technology to create and retain highly paid Pennsylvania jobs. And basically LifeAir is one of our early stage clients who basically exhibits the characteristics that we look for in a client, creating and retaining these jobs, creating technologies that advance the human condition. In this case, Dr. Warlow and her team pivoted quickly in addition to having the air systems that kill COVID and other pathogens, they were also able to quickly pivot for the mask sanitation unit. So her company basically is doing two jobs for us as we look to recover from the pandemic. One, creating and retaining those great jobs. Two, developing technology that will help us address this issue as well as future issues down the road.
Doug Engler, you're the regional manager in Lehigh Valley of Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Northeastern Pennsylvania. I mean, considering where we are in the middle of this pandemic, how many cases continue to be diagnosed every day, the number of deaths and the number of people who are hospitalized, this would seem to be, I think, an understatement to say one of the most important things that Ben Franklin probably has ever been involved with.
Well, actually, Ben Franklin's been involved with several different companies that have had some great importance, and absolutely Dr. Warlow's company is top of the charts there. And it is quite impressive the technology that was brought together to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Warlow, this sounds fantastic. I know that there's people out there listening saying, okay, we need to get this everywhere. Is that realistic that do we have the capacity? Do you have the capacity to expand this so that it can be in many, many places? And I have to ask about cost, because obviously that's something that, an institution, a company, any kind of building that would want to install one of your systems would have to think about.
Absolutely. And the cost, to answer that question immediately, I mean, I remain on the science and the technology side, but the cost is really dependent upon the size of the area and which of our solutions will deliver the comprehensive remediation. So it's really size dependent, but we work with the engineers of each space to make, to develop the solution that's absolutely best for them from a cost perspective and from a delivery perspective.
What about expansion?
We actually are fortunate. We have multiple manufacturers teed up and ready to go that we've already been using prior to COVID. And as far as expanding a manufacturing capacity, that's actually not an issue.
Schools would seem to be a place that this would be ideal for. I didn't hear you mention schools other than on the university level, and that sounded like it was healthcare facilities. Mm-hmm. Is this something that Pennsylvania schools could use?
Absolutely. We have had inbound from schools. I only mentioned the list of where we are already installed, but we have had inbound from schools. And absolutely, assuming that we can, place one of our solutions in their ductwork, in their HVAC system. It's, again, our technology, it doesn't matter where the air comes from or where the space it's serving, it will deliver the kill that has been modeled.
Yeah, when we hear something about leaving the windows open, that doesn't sound very scientific. So having a system, that an airflow system that you could rely on that we know can mitigate the virus would seem to, produce a lot more confidence than just opening the window, especially in the wintertime. Hey, I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Catherine Warlow, CEO and founder of Life Air Systems. Laura Appler, Chief Marketing Officer with Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Northeastern Pennsylvania. Doug Engler is the Lehigh Valley Regional Manager of Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Northeast PA. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Everyone, have yourself a great day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITS Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.